this is getting so fancy.
So fancy, dancy.
It didn't used to give us a countdown before, so now we've got a countdown and video, and it's like, oh.
It's almost like everyone's doing this now.
Oh my God. I mean, yeah. I'm literally giving like a 10-minute presentation tomorrow morning on how to start a podcast. So
nice. Yeah. Well, at least we're very experienced. So
I mean, first almost step 3 years worth at this point.
Have a microphone.
That's and literally what I said.
Second step is have friends. And third step is hope they share it.
So like to sum up my 10-minute presentation, the first step was pick a topic you're actually interested in.
Smart, smart.
You know,
good
because
start.
If you're not interested, nobody listening to you is going to be interested either. They'll be
precisely
able to know.
Because if it's just like they can hear you smiling, they can hear you frowning.
Yes.
So if you're not interested, they can hear your boredom.
Exactly. And then like the second step was get good equipment, a microphone and probably an interface, you know. And it's like, you can use like a USB microphone and those are great. But ultimately like an interface is going to give you more.
Necessary.
Well, not just more necessary, but it's going to give you like more control over what your microphone records.
For sure. For sure.
And then like the third thing I said was like hardware. Oh, software, you know, good editing software.
Smart.
And then the fourth thing
also
was
good.
Like, you know, like research which platform you want to host on. So
good idea. All great ideas.
So yeah,
no conspiracies there.
No conspiracies there. So I'm really interested to see how people like my 10-minute presentation because I'm taking like a instructor course, like how to be like an instructor. So
oh
yeah. So and you know we have to do a 10, 20, 50 minute discuss like course or like lesson plan, and then the fourth one we have to do is a 50 minute instructional like I show you how to do something.
I see.
I'm not looking forward to that. That's going to be a while.
You have to make sure people actually learn things. You're like, I can tell you till you're blue in the face, but whether or not you actually retain it is entirely up to you.
Yep. So like, you know, the 10 minute easy, the 20 minute, I might just pull like a cryptid script and just revamp it to like being a teaching thing. The 50 minute, I might pull one of our conspiracy scripts that's longer.
Nice. Yes, exactly. Permission granted. Well, welcome back to another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids. If you are confused, this is Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. We cover cryptids and now some conspiracies. We have kind of started to pull away a little bit from official conspiracies, but I promise you, it's same, mm-hmm. but different.
Same feeling,
but still same
feeling, just more abstract topics.
Exactly. So, but I have a really fun one for you guys today. I hear Sammy's got really something mm-hmm. really cool planned for you. So it is time to, is it time to flip a coin?
Actually,
I have news. Where am I going?
Yeah.
I have news. Speaking of why we don't actually talk about conspiracies anymore.
Okay.
So this is our news today. I saw this a couple of days ago. So remember, you know, Houston had that freak snowstorm, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it was nuts. I mean, it went down to like what, negative 17 degrees, a little 11-year-old boy like died in his home. I mean, awful. And then just for the ultimate slap in the face, sometime last week, I want to say it was like Wednesday, I think mm-hmm. it was 84 degrees in Texas. I'm sure you are aware. I know you are there. But like, holy, oh my God, you went from people dying in their homes to 84 degrees. Okay. So we are mm-hmm. obviously the earth is not well, obviously. Something is wrong.
Right.
But naturally, people who haven't gone the route of the science, sciencey explanation of this mm-hmm. global warming, that there's a problem, they have, started to claim that the snow is fake. So, and here's why. They're claiming that because they could go outside and ball up a whole bunch of snow and hold a lighter to it. Now, granted, people in Texas have not necessarily had snow like this before. So, mm-hmm. you know. This is an unfamiliar situation, right? And stuff. Now, now they're claiming that the snow doesn't melt if you hold a lighter to it.
Right.
So the way science works is if something is super, 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 super cold, and then you hold a lighter to it, mm-hmm. something that's called sublimation,
yep.
which is where that solid goes directly into a gas. So it is technically melting. It's just not becoming water first. It's just literally turning into vapor. So it's not going to yep. run off into your hand unless you sit there and hold it, and it's just going to yep. turn into water the longer you hold it. So they weren't doing their due diligence and doing a little Google search and going a little bit beyond YouTube than
despite having the wealth of information at our hands, nobody uses it.
Right? Right. just so if you see
5 minutes
about,
on Google.
If you see this about the Texas snow being fake, it is not fake. It is science. That's how science works. That's how you cannot burn snowballs and make them like melt. That science doesn't that work like yeah. that. Like you could technically, eventually you're going to get like some form of water, but it's going to be for other reasons than fire literally right. hitting ice. Right. Yeah. So hence why they don't mix, guys. Right. Yep. So anyway, mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of interesting. I wanted to kind of chit chat about this interesting phenomenon that showed up. This literal conspiracy theory that like bubbled up under us and then yeah. kind of fizzled out because enough people were like, that's enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I did see that. Like I said, I did see that conspiracy theory pop up on TikTok in the last like week or two. And I was like, oh,
exactly.
Oh, okay.
You TikTokers and your conspiracy theories. You need to do better, dude, Sammy. Like you need to tell your friends to knock this off.
I know. I mean, my friends aren't the ones doing it, but it's like, you know, like I've definitely.
You're on TikTok.
Made it,
they're all your friends. That's your friends.
I've definitely made it to the conspiracy side of TikTok. So, you know, I'm seeing some of this stuff and it's like, oh boy, you guys, you need to.
Oh boy.
Just research a little bit, please. But
anyway, now that we have done that that side of business and everything, now we can flip a coin. Now that I've jumped yes. the gun, mm-hmm. now we can actually check out the trigger.
And you actually found the penny, right? Or Ian
I did.
Found the penny.
The penny. I don't know where I found it. It was somewhere on the desk. On the brighter side, the desk has been like remodeled. Like we got a full on like podcasty setup in here,
that's
guys.
Awesome.
Well, took also, us long enough. It's been several different iterations of this, but
also speaking of the penny, I actually went through and tallied up how many times the penny has picked me first versus you.
Oh my God. How many more pennies are your thoughts worth than mine?
So you've gone first 18 times.
Oh,
and that's not including
no.
That's not including the times that like, you know, guests went first, just you. Uh-huh. The times you went
just
first
me.
18 times.
Yay.
Guess how many times I went first.
Well, considering we've got like 50 episodes out, what is it, like 35?
30.
Ah, Sammy.
So and like I said, that's now with me, that's also tallying up like the times I went first with our guests. So
true. And so they didn't get a chance either because you and fate have it, you know, in the bag apparently.
Yeah.
You and Lady Luck are like licking each other's lollipops, you know. No. Anyway, let's shake some pennies, guys. Okay, so I'm gonna pick first because I'm apparently behind in this.
You gotta catch up.
Apparently Lady Luck doesn't like me. All right, so we are going to shake it up, uh-huh. and I'm going to pick heads. And it's heads!
There you go, 19.
I totally didn't just cheat there, guys. It totally wasn't tails, and
totally
I'm not lying.
Cheating. Mm-hmm.
Totally not lying. No, I just totally want to go first. All right, so I'm vetoing. I'm going to commandeer the ship here.
Okay, go for it.
All right. So since, like I said, we are talking about some a little bit different topics, right? We are going to kind of expand some things. And actually, through doing research on this one, I kind of found that it's kind of fun. It's related anyway. So, but we're going to talk more about like false advertising and scams.
Okay.
So specifically, snake oil. You know, you've heard of snake oil salesmen mm-hmm. and stuff. One of my favorite movies is you know, Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street and
right.
stuff. And, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen in the film version. Mm-hmm. he's a snake oil salesman, right? And stuff.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, been idolizing the barber and everything. But he's, you know, he's out on the streets selling his magical elixir and stuff, and which Sweeney Todd calls him out on, right? So, but it's snake oil, though, itself is a euphemism for deceptive marketing. You could also be called a snake oil salesman, which is a common expression for someone who deceives people in order to get money from them. It's not necessarily that they're selling medicine. They're just, you know, you can tell when you're like, okay, you're selling snake oil. You know,
right.
There's certain, I'm sure people have been approached by, friends who've been sucked into.
Oh, are we talking about MLM?
Yes. I'm not going to be specific, but some of them are snake oils.
Mm-hmm,
and also before
mm-hmm.
we continue, though, I do want to have like a little trigger warning for the rest of the episode. I am going to mention some drugs because we are going to talk about some medicine, but I thought this was really interesting. So
okay.
Before we move on, just wanted to throw that out there, guys. If you have any trigger warnings and stuff, brief mention of drugs. But first, a brief history of snake oil. So the term comes from the petroleum-based mineral oil, or snake oil, that was once sold as a cure-all elixir for a litany of issues. In fact, many 19th century in the United States and 18th century European entrepreneurs, they were a little ahead of us in the deception across the pond. In fact, a lot of the times I found they started over there and they're like, oh, you know who would buy this? Americans.
Yankees.
yeah, there.
And we're still doing it
anyway,
to this day.
Right. They still do it now.
Yeah.
So these snake oils, though, were advertised and sold. They sold the mineral oil, and they often mixed it with various active and inactive household herbs, spices, drugs, and compounds, but not actually containing really one bit of snake or even a snake-derived substance, for that matter.
Okay.
They were usually pitched as snake oil liniments, kind of like a toner on your face, so they were like a heat treatment and stuff. They were like, here. You know,
okay.
Slap this on your face. Just look like an even bigger idiot because you're smacking yourself in the face while you do it.
Like Kevin from Home Alone?
Exactly. Or what is it? The little girl in Despicable Me?
It's so fluffy, I'm gonna die.
Exactly. But they eventually came with some frivolous claim, or they usually came with some frivolous claim that about its efficacy as a panacea, or basically a fountain of youth that was in a bottle and stuff. The salesman promised it would be a cure-all for diseases and be an elixir for a lasting life. I mean, how could you not, guys? How could you not?
Right, yes, of course.
In fact, from the 18th century into well into the 20th century, patent medicines that claimed to be panacea were extremely common, usually among vendors trying to cover up the facts that the drugs were addictive, like cocaine, amphetamine, alcohol, and opium-based concoctions that were to be sold at medicine shows as like medication or products promoting health. They're like, oh, no,
ooh,
is it
boy.
Cocaine? What? Cocaine? No. Oh, but... But the lines in your face will look so much, you'll be so much more awake.
That reminds me of like a meme that I've seen floating around like lots of times where it's like, you know, oh, to be an old timey doctor, you've got ghosts in your blood. You should do cocaine about it.
Exactly. In fact, actually, if you guys want a really like really, really good exploration to that whole era, The Nick, they just put the first two seasons on HBO right now. It was originally a Cinemax show. I loved it when it was on Cinemax. They got a third season. I feel like they totally threw it away. So that's why I kind of refuse to watch it right now, because it doesn't really resolve itself. But it does explore the growth of medicine around like 1910 in the United States. Super, super cool.
Interesting.
So anyway, Clive Owen's in it. It's awesome. But anyway, patent medicines originated, though, in England, where, like I said, when the first royal patent was granted to Reverend Richard Stoughton's elixir in 1712.
Okay.
The FDA wasn't created in the United States until 1906, so that was actually the first version of the FDA that we would have. So there was still several hundred years off of any real regulation as far as health and safety here. So you want a patent, you get a freaking patent, sir.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, I actually found the original patent for a cordial by the name of, by the name of, this is funny, Stoughton's Elixir, Magnum Stomachium.
Okay.
Or the Great Cordial Elixir.
Okay.
Otherwise called the Stomach Tincture.
Okay.
Also known as Bitter Drops. So it has like lots of little,
lots
AKA,
of names.
AKA.
Uh-huh.
He claimed
the tummy ticklers. Okay.
The tummy tincture.
The tummy tincture. I love that.
He claimed, though, that it was a cure for gout, which was as popular as stomach ulcers in the 1950s and tuberculosis, like pretty much throughout every single romantic comedy ever.
Mm. Right.
They're not romantic comedy, but you know, the romantic dramas where it's like, if she's dying, oh, she coughed up blood, oh, it's probably tuberculosis. You know, the easiest tell all in any movie. But actually, I thought this was kind of interesting. Many 18th century doctors took their cues on common gout from the physician George Schein, who saw gout as the result of blood stagnating in the extremities. And in a sense, it was like a body safety valve. So like the stuff had pooled in like the fingers and toes. And if they had pooled anywhere else, like in your organs, it would have wreaked havoc. But they're like, oh, thank God you have gout. You know, it just pooled there for you. So he derived his ideas, though, from a man known as the 17th century English Hippocrates, who argued that gout was the result of ease of voluptuousness, high living, and too free of use of wine and other spirituous liquors. And this was Sydenham that created this. He was known as the English Hippocrates at the time.
Why do I feel like I've heard that recently?
Right.
I feel like I've heard that the whole, like, you know, the gout is like the rich person's disease or something like that.
It's actually very common. It's a, what's up?
It was in Disenchanted, the show on Netflix. Yeah.
And it's like actually well known gout. As it specifically, usually, and I'll eventually get there and stuff, but, gout is typically associated with eating too much red meat. And if you have the ability to store and cook red meat and eat it on that kind of scale, then you're more likely to be a little, you know, you're more well off at that time.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes
sense. Therefore being, you know, so, and you're also more likely to be drinking more often. You're drinking, you know, higher distilled liquors because you're not dealing, you know, drinking toilet water, you know.
But this guy also moving around as much. It's usually more of a sedentary lifestyle. Gotcha.
Exactly. You're not exercising like the people who are in the field. They're constantly working. They're working off any of the meat that they're eating.
Right.
So bleeding and purging, though, would be was considered counterproductive to this guy because then you would just clear everything out and make room for more just poison. So he recommended this light diet of plenty of fluid, regular doses of bitters, which was a distilled alcohol infused with watercress, horseradish, wormwood, and angelica root. So he wanted to cure gout with a steak condiment.
we've tried weirder things, so.
We have. So, like I said, gout was a status symbol for a while. While it caused severe agonizing pain in the joints, it indicated a degree of civilization, luxury, or ease, and sometimes even the ability to read. They're like, oh, you have gout? Oh, you could read. Oh,
That's something. Now, isn't gout, if left untreated, like, can lead to amputation?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. It'll just eat through you. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
So other popular elixirs, though, at the time that kind of branched off of this same concept of treating gout were Bateman's pectoral drops, Dr. Radcliffe's famous purging elixir, Daffy's elixir, which we're going to talk about in a second, Godfrey's cordial, and Radcliffe's royal tincture. All of them drew on the fiery potency of alcohol, which had probably caused the gout in the first place, and they actually had more in common with Sydenham's bitters than most physicians would care to admit. So, pretty much this whole like treating gout was all in this like same group here of ingredients. Whether or not it was actually effective, it kind of remains to be seen, but not really. It was a snake oil.
Right.
Snakes, though, in general, I will break away from that, from specifically Siddons and Mr. Stoughton's. Snakes weren't totally excluded in the 18th century Europe, especially from the UK. Viper oils had been commonly recommended for several ailments, actually. Rattlesnake venom in particular was popular for rheumatism and skin diseases.
I heard about that,
again. Whether it actually worked kind of remains to be seen, although there have been accounts of oil being obtained from the fat of various vipers from around the world. Little research has actually been done on the claims of its effectiveness on actual ailments, which I think actually, in a way, is kind of a crying shame. Like, I feel like we should look into the, you know, medicinal properties of snake venom because, like,
if it
can do bad things to you, I'm sure there is a possibility of, you know, the other side. So I think that maybe that would be kind of an interesting thing to look into. And and then of course there's always a plant in the crowd that makes snake oil salesmen successful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Again, depicted in Sweeney Todd, the little boy. Yep. There's always a plant. The snake oil salesman can hawk his product all he wants, but he has to get someone to buy it to make it take off.
Right.
So what do you do if the people won't bite? You hire a customer. They'd mm-hmm. often have an assistant in the crowd that was proving their point. And again, if you want an example of this, you know, Sweeney Todd. These doctors, though, would then, or doctors, quote unquote, usually actually reverends, I've found. They're really? Usually members of the clergy. They would then often leave town quickly before anyone realized that the product didn't work. And mm-hmm. so then no one could search for them to complain. So the days before you got the runaround with the robot on the phone, then you had to run around your town looking for the snake oil salesman.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, yeah. So they've always had ways to elude us when they've done something wrong. But there is actually a case, kind of-ish, of a snake oil salesman getting a little justice. There was Clark Stanley's Snake Oil Liminant was produced by Clark Stanley, a.k.a. the Rattlesnake King. He had a name. He wasn't the Tiger King, guys. This is the Rattlesnake King.
The Rattlesnake King. Okay.
His product was tested by the U.S. Government Bureau of Chemistry, which was the precursor to what would become the FDA in 1916. Okay. So, like I said, there was like a what would eventually become the FDA. It was actually called the Bureau of Chemistry.
Okay.
We started there. Kind of cool. And then we've obviously broken off because there's lots of different kinds of chemistry.
Right. Yep.
Tests showed at that time that the snake oil contained mineral oil, 1% fatty oil, which was assumed to be tallow, capsaicin from chili peppers,
right,
turpentine, and camphor. So basically a drastically overpriced and just like a minimum value. There was just like really nothing to it.
Camphor oil. Stanley, isn't that like used in lamps and lanterns and stuff like that?
Yeah, I believe camphor. So. Yeah. So it was like, so you don't like want to put this.
He was selling them like a spicy candle.
Pretty much that you put on your body.
Yeah, because it's just spice like a fat. Candle. It's like fat, like lamp oil and chili pepper oil.
And chili peppers.
It's literally a spicy candle that you rub on your body.
Exactly. Well, he didn't get away totally unscathed. They burned him a little bit. Stanley faced federal prosecution for the peddling of mineral oil fraudulently. In his 1916 civil hearing in the U.S. District Court of Rhode Island, he pled no contest, but also no admission of guilt. So he was like, I'm not going to argue with you, but I'm not going to say I did it either.
Right. Yeah.
His plea was accepted and he was fined $20, which I adjusted for inflation. And it's about $500 now. They were like, just give us $500, whatever. So now there's two more elixirs that I want to talk about that I thought were kind of interesting. There's Daffy's elixir that I mentioned. This was an extremely common name used by several patent medicines, originally designed for diseases of the stomach, but was later marketed as a universal cure. Again, one of those panaceas. It was popular in Britain and in the U.S. in the 18th and 19th centuries. Rumors said that it was invented by clergymen. Again, member of the church, Thomas Daffy.
Weird. That is so weird to me.
Right? He was from Redmill, Leicestershire in 1647. So no one can ask him, right? So by the time we're selling his stuff, this guy is long dead.
Interesting.
He named it the Elixir Salutis, or the Elixir of Health, and promoted it as a genetic cure-all. One early recipe for a true Daffy from 1700 lists aniseed, brandy, cochineal, which is that bug that they use for red dyes. Elecampane, which is like a flower, also known as horse heel. It's kind of like looks like a dandelion. Fennel seed, jalap, which is not a derivative or a slang for jalapenos. It's a cathartic drug that is mostly obsolete in Western medicine, but the plant does grow in Mexico. So it probably is jalap. But manna, yes, manna, like the god kind of manna, is in the recipe. Parsley seed, a raisin, rhubarb.
A raisin. Just
a
one.
Raisin.
Just one.
Singular raisin. Rhubarb, saffron, senna, which is a legume, and Spanish licorice.
So it had saffron in it.
Yes.
That's extremely hard to come by.
It is. It
and
is.
So
especially
expensive.
Those little
teeny
tiny fibers. Yeah, exactly. Really expensive. So, I mean, Although that's really interesting. I wonder how they got a hold of that. I wonder if it was more common in some areas.
Maybe. Or maybe it was just more common back then and they were putting it in all their tinctures and now we can't find it because they used it all up.
Maybe it's like a raisin. Maybe it was like a tiny hair of saffron.
Just one hair.
But chemical analysis actually found it to be basically a laxative that was made from mostly alcohol. No. So here, drink this until you poop your pants.
It's like, oh no, I can't even imagine. So it's like, here, get drunk and you know, crap yourself.
Right. But apparently, this is what it claimed to cure all. It was apparently useful for the following ailments.
Okay.
Convulsion fits. Yes, kind of. Convulsion fits. Consumption and bad digestive. So kind of. Okay. Fever. Hemorrhoids. Okay. I don't know about that. Overeating.
Yeah, nope.
Fits of the mother or hysteria. So if your mom, you're going crazy, you just, here, take this.
Well,
poop
most
yourself.
Of the time, hysteria is just another word for for women being on their menstrual cycle.
Exactly. Exactly.
So just give this to her and she'll, you know, she'll be on the toilet her entire menstrual cycle and you won't have to deal with her.
Which, joke's on them, she was probably constipated anyway, knowing women's bodies. Ladies, I hope you enjoyed that. And another thing called vapors of the spleen, which I could not find a reference to now. So I guess you got a stinky spleen.
I've never heard of that before.
I haven't either. But although I guess the closest thing that I could find was if somebody was a really, really frequent smoker, that they would assume that, like, you know, obviously it comes out of your pores and stuff. So they were assuming it was leaking from your organs and stuff. That was the closest thing I could get to it and stuff. But I have no idea if that's right.
Interesting.
It also treated against green sickness, or what's also known as, which again, there was really no agreement on what the green sickness meant. They assume it was hypochromic anemia, which makes the body look green,
right?
Which would make sense. But another version, like, that was an advertisement for this stuff, claimed that it was basically to get your lady hot and heavy. Like,
oh, they were saying that it was like a
So I don't know. Maybe it's like if your wife claims she's got a headache. Oh no, I've got the green sickness. They're like, here, give her this. She'll poop herself and then want to be all over you. I don't know why.
Oh my god, like a. I don't even want to think about like an aphrodisiac that's also a laxative.
A laxative. Yeah. No.
A laxadisiac.
Anyway. So laxadisiac. Oh no. So now on to children's distempers that it covers.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Apparently it would treat kids for worms. Rickets, which is like weak bones, how you sometimes would see kids with bowed legs.
Right.
They claim that this would fix that.
I can see the worms.
Kidney stones.
I can honestly see the worms, because then you'd poop them all out real quick. That one I could
definitely.
Absolutely see.
Definitely.
Gross,
especially then
it.
Kids obviously would technically have worms, you know, more often sometimes than adults would, because they don't necessarily know to pick those out. But not necessarily do the adults either. So this would also treat against worms, rickets, kidney stones, convulsions in kids, gripes, which was kind of like your tummy aches basically. King's evil, which, oh my god, don't Google King's evil. It's basically a it's essentially where it's a side effect of tuberculosis, where your lymph nodes get so infected and hardened, they come through your skin in your neck. Yeah.
Whoa.
And apparently this would treat that. But it was a big deal at the time. It was something that was untreated tuberculosis could eventually turn into. And so they were like, yeah, slap that on the bottle too. Sure. Do that one too.
I should not have looked up a picture of that.
Right. I told you. I told you. Did I tell you or did I tell you?
So, yeah, there's a trigger warning right there. If you're going to Google King's Evil, be forewarned. Woo! That is a gross picture.
It's a gross picture. So this would also treat joint evil, which sounds like rheumatoid or arthritis, or even gout, gas, gout and rheumatism, kidney stones, colic or tummy ache, tuberculosis, dropsy, which is pure, like poor fluid retention. We still see dropsy, like dropsy and scurvy usually kind of went hand in hand.
Right. Yeah.
And scurvy as another thing it treated, which, you know, as we all know, eat an orange or your scars will open up. Gross. So after Daffy's death, though, in 1680, the recipe was left to his daughter Catherine and his kinsmen, his sons, Anthony and Daniel, who were apothecaries in Nottingham. So great. Okay. There's more doctors in the family. You know, or not doctors, but, you know, the pharmacists, apothecaries. Anthony Daffy moved to London in 1690 and began to sell the product using pamphlets. He then died and his widow picked up the hobby in 1863. Then, or sorry, in 1693. Okay. Then their daughter took over around 1707. Mm-hmm. By the early 18th century, the product was being advertised in the emerging national and local newspapers. In fact, there were several copycats by then that admittedly used inferior alcohol rather than the brandy that's in the recipe.
Okay.
So after he died, his son takes it, and then the family just starts like peddling it everywhere. So the original guy is long dead, and then they're like, it's in the United States, it's international, it's everywhere. Okay. And then, like I said, there are some copycats. This is when things get a little messy. In 1775, William and Cluer Dicey and a company of Bow Churchyard claimed that the sole rights of the manufacturer of True Daffy's Elixir, although the recipe wasn't under any patent, they took the marketing to the United States. Okay. So they were like, we got the recipe. We're making it now. Nothing you can do about it. Get over it.
Okay.
But then shortly after that, proprietorship was also claimed by Peter Swinton of Salisbury Court and his son, Anthony Daffy Swinton, who may have been descended from the original inventor. So then there was this argument. They're like, okay, but we actually own it. So then those two actually kind of like merged in a way, because then from there it passed on to Dicey and Sutton, which are basically both of them, and then later on to Messrs. W. Sutton and Company of Enfield, Middlesex, who then marketed it through the 19th century. And it was so popular, it was actually mentioned in tons of pop culture, and I couldn't even find when they stopped producing this. But it went on for a really, really long time. So that was kind of an interesting one. I thought was like, you know, the dude who made it is long dead, and it is produced for an eternity afterward.
Okay.
There was also Beecham's Pills, which is another laxative. That's what I've kind of found. A lot of these kind of really upset your stomach. It was first marketed in 1842 in Wigan, Lancashire. And it was invented by Thomas Beecham, grandfather of the conductor, Sir Thomas Beecham of the London Philharmonic, who actually died in the 60s. But he was very, very famous. It was advertised like other patent medicines as a cure-all, but they actually did have a positive effect on the digestive process. They were a combination of aloe, ginger, and soap, and its effectiveness made it stand out from other remedies for sale in the mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. Their pills and their marketing were the basis for Beecham's patent pills, which became Beecham's estates and pills in 1924, 8 years after Beecham lost one of his sons. The pills continued production through a couple of companies, Beecham Pills Limited, Beecham Pills or Beecham Pharmaceuticals Limited, Beecham Healthcare, and Smith Kline Beecham. But those pills were eventually discontinued in 1998.
Ooh, were they marketed as a laxative by the 90s or? Okay.
It was still laxative. I have actually an advertisement here. It was known to dislodge bile, stir up the liver, cure sick headache, female ailments, remove disease, and promote good health. So they were still touting it that way.
If you're sick, just poop your guts out.
Just pop one of these. Exactly.
When in doubt, now, poop it out.
The last one I want to mention actually was originally I was going to stop there, and then I found this last one. I found Lydia Estes Pinkham.
Okay.
And this one's for the ladies. And I know, guys, you can whine that you're here for a conspiracy podcast, but I'm going to learn you something that could get you laid in the future because this is kind of cool. So if you're into women, got girls too. I'm just, you know. Okay. So she
we
lived
don't discriminate.
In. From 1819 to 1883, she died when she was 64.
Okay.
She was an American businesswoman and an inventor and marketer of something that was once considered snake oil by reverse marketing.
Okay.
She was born in the manufacturing city of Lynn, Massachusetts, the 10th of 12 kids to William and Rebecca Estes. The Estes were an old Quaker family, but by the time Lydia was born in 1819, her father had become wealthy through real estate and risen to the status of gentleman farmer. So Lydia was formally educated and worked as a school teacher before she eventually married in 1843, when she was about 24. So she's not a dumb lady. She's very educated. Like, she's like, she had some status already, even before she was married.
Okay.
Apparently, though, despite being from a family of Quakers, the Estes were actually strong abolitionists and anti-segregationists. In fact, Frederick Douglass was apparently a friend and a neighbor of the family, and he was a very educated man, too. So it kind of gives you an idea of just kind of where this chick's coming from.
Like the company that they kept and everything, yeah.
Yeah. In 1843, when Lydia was 24, she married Isaac Pinkham, a 29-year-old shoe manufacturer. He tried lots of businesses following that with little to no success, including real estate. He was like, okay, I'll try what your dad did, and he couldn't do that either. Lydia eventually had their first son a year later after they were married. Then she lost a child. Then she had another boy in 1848, and then a third son in 1852, and then a daughter in 1857. All of these kids would eventually be involved in her business.
Okay.
I promise there's a point.
Okay. No, no, no.
Many women of her time, Pinkham brewed her own home remedies, mm-hmm. for which she continually collected recipes. And her remedy for female complaints became extremely popular. After a while, she just gave it away to neighbors. They're like, hey, I'm on my period. You got some of that stuff that
right.
can I have some? And it was this vegetable compound, apparently.
Okay.
And at the time, because, you know, we were still figuring out, you know, medicines and everything, we were
right,
still,
of course,
you know, figure out what works, what doesn't, what's really effective. And sometimes people were prescribed calomel, which is a derived from mercury. And oftentimes it's same thing we face today, where the side effects are often worse than what you're trying to treat. And right. so women were like, I don't want to freaking die. I just want my uterus to stop feeling like it's going to crawl out of my freaking body. Like, right. come on, like, can I have some help? So they would brew these things at home. And apparently hers was so freaking popular, she would just give it away to neighbors. She's like, okay, there's some on the porch. Like, just go ahead and take some.
Okay.
And eventually, Isaac Pinkham, her husband, was totally financially ruined in the 1870s. And by 1875, they were like, you know,
let's try.
This is not
that.
A bad idea.
Right.
We should probably sell this. I'm surprised it took them 5 years to figure that out. But maybe there were like all kinds of roadblocks. Who knows?
Right.
As far as trying to get a business, especially a woman, because her name was on it.
Right.
So what this stuff was an herbal alcoholic women's tonic for menstrual and menopausal problems, which medical experts dismissed as a quack remedy, but it's actually still on sale today, like I mentioned, in a modified form.
Okay.
And so if you're a woman, you know this, but and some guys might know this too and stuff, but even today, women's bodies are studied as men's bodies with pesky hormones.
Right.
So hysteria, period cramps, everything. And this is true today as much as it is then. Mm-hmm. So they're like, there's nothing wrong with you. How can there be a tincture for something there's nothing wrong with you? How can there be a remedy for something when there's right. nothing wrong with you? Just get over it, right? So because of this aggressive marketing strategy that she had, she was like, she basically put it on the table. She was our first, what was that nurse that used to have the late night talk show? Hang on. Was it Nurse Sue?
I have no idea.
Sue Johansson. Yes. Okay. Nurse Sue. And she was a nurse practitioner who would be on it like super, super, super late at night. And she would have all these sex toys in front of her and she would answer questions. I love Nurse Sue.
Okay.
So, she was kind of the Nurse Sue at the time because she would invite women. She's like, if you have questions about this, just write me. I will write you back. Right. It was, she had this really aggressive marketing strategy that was just like, you have a problem. Ladies, I understand. We have a problem. If you want to solve it, here you go.
Right.
And so these other guys that didn't agree with it were like, there's no problem. This is snake oil. You're just selling something to make money.
Right.
And trying to convince that there was this, you know, this other side to it.
Right. Right.
And so eventually, she, like I said, she would invite people to write to her And she would write back personally. They did find that eventually her company became so big that even after she died, the letters still continued. So they're like, it probably wasn't always her responding after a while.
Right, she probably had ghostwriters and stuff like that, of course.
Exactly. But so they did continue it afterward. But that was a really, really big part of her getting her word out there.
Okay.
But so what's in it? What the heck is in this stuff? There's pleurisy root, which is a diaphoretic, which stops you sweating.
Okay.
An antispasmodic, so stops your cramping. Mm-hmm. A carminative, which stops your toots. Okay. And an anti-inflammatory, which just makes everything calm down.
Right, right.
There's also life root, which is a traditional uterine tonic, diuretic, anti-inflammatory, and emmenagogue, which is used for cramps and to, you know, get your stuff going. If you know, if you're sometimes when you're stressed out and it's like, okay, it still hasn't started. And there's like, honestly, I'm not pregnant. I guarantee you.
Right.
And so it would kickstart things for you.
Okay.
It would also be fenugreek.
Your cycle more regular.
Exactly.
Okay. Gotcha.
There's also fenugreek, which is, a vulinary, which is wound healing, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Okay.
Anti-inflammatory, antispasmodic, tonic, emmenagogue, and a lactator.
Okay.
Also unicorn root, which was used by several Native American tribes for cramps. Uterine prolapse, which, oh my God, you could treat that with a freaking herb. Oh my God. Pelvic congestion and to improve ovarian function. So okay. It's also a kind of an early IVF in a way.
Okay. Right.
Also black cohosh, which was also an emmenagogue, an antispasmodic, restorative, nervine, hypotensive, and also traditionally used for treating menopausal symptoms like hot flashes, mood problems, perspiration, heart palpitations, and dry between me down there's.
Okay.
There was also drinking alcohol that was in it, relieving muscle stress, reducing pain, and affecting your mood. Now, like I said, you can still actually buy this. This is still technically in production.
That sounds like it's amazing. Like,
there's like nothing bad in it.
What's
like,
it called?
You go, girl. So apparently, you can buy this one. It's not an official endorsement, though, guys. Although I might go try this myself, just you know, for research.
Yeah, you absolutely should. And
just to give it a shot.
If it does everything it says it does, why don't more women know about this?
Exactly. Exactly. Now it is more of like a natural remedy, so maybe that's why it's this. But science is science, guys. Right. As of 2004, Newmark Laboratories of Edison, New Jersey has been marketing a similar product called Lydia Pinkham Herbal Compound.
Okay.
And it is carried by Walgreens, CVS, and Rite Aid, if you're curious. Those ingredients, though, that it has listed are motherwort, gentian, Jamaican dogwood, pleurisy root, so it does have that, licorice, black cohosh, and dandelion. So I thought this was super interesting. I hope you guys learned stuff. I certainly learned stuff because I was just curious about snake oils.
It's super fascinating. And it's like, it's super fascinating. And there always needs to be more information out there for women and ladies because it's like, there's just so little information because like you said, so much of like, you know, like the female body is studied from the perspective of men, you know, and it's like, oh, they've got the same bodies as us, but just different hormones. And it's like, there's so much more going on out there with your bodies and there's just so little information out there. So it's like, anytime that we can help out and put out some information out there that people need, you know, and that information is just as important to men, you know, because it helps us understand our female counterparts better.
Exactly. Your partners, your friends,
your mothers, your sisters, your daughters. Yeah.
For instance, a heart attack looks completely different sometimes between women and men.
Yeah. So,
like men, you know, you get your chest pain, your arm pain and everything you can, you know, that's like what we all know. But, you know, a woman can go into a doctor's office and say, I'm nauseous. I'm really, really nauseous. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, you know, take this. You're fine.
Right.
She could be having a heart attack.
Right.
And so it looks completely different. And if you don't know that, then, you know, lives can be saved by understanding each other's bodies. We are not just men with pesky hormones. We do have pesky hormones, but
yeah, well, you know, we all have pesky hormones. I mean, that's just part of the human complex. So
exactly. We just have different kinds.
Right.
So anyway, that's my story. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
I liked it. I love learning about, you know, like just the different Well, I mean, you know me. I love history, you know, yeah. And it's like medical history is just fascinating with everything we've done. I mean, we've talked multiple times on this podcast alone about consumption and the different ways they treated it. You know, I mean, they literally would like cremate a body and mix the ashes in with water and have you drink it.
You wouldn't get it.
As a tuberculosis treatment. You know, so I mean, it's like, yeah, it's insane just how far medical practice has come in just a couple hundred years, you know.
Absolutely. It's insane. Even the past 100, but yeah, absolutely. This was super, super interesting.
Liked it. So, okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about my kind of abstract cryptid. So
nice.
And forewarning, this will be a lengthy episode. So
yes.
We're already 45 minutes in and I've still got a topic to talk about. So bear with us and we hope you guys enjoy the extra content this week. Like I said, my quote unquote cryptid this week is a little bit more abstract. Back in season one, I talked about a non-animal cryptid, which was the man-eating trees. And since then, pretty much every topic I've covered that wasn't a conspiracy theory was like an animal or beast cryptid. Mm. Well, I mentioned this one like a few episodes ago. I think I like posed like a rhetorical question asking if this could be considered a cryptid. And I decided I finally want to talk about it. It's a supposed mythical island that disappears and reappears. And some people claim that they've been to it. So this is an island cryptid, so to speak, known as High Brasil, otherwise known simply as Brasil. Not to be confused with the country of Brazil.
Yes.
Or the Irish underground electronica band High Brasil, which they named themselves after this island. And yes, I did listen to them throughout my research.
Nice, nice, nice. So. I definitely listened to Sweeney Todd throughout mine. So
so yeah, this band is, you know, definitely like your traditional like kind of electronica music. But so High Brasil, and that's spelled Brasil, and the high is H-Y. So H-Y hyphen Brasil. High Brasil is supposedly an island located 200 miles or 321 kilometers west of Ireland that, according to legend, is cloaked in mist and cannot be found except for one day every 7 years when the mist suddenly clear.
Ooh.
And supposedly you can see it from Ireland. You can see it from parts of Ireland.
Because,
you know, 200 miles isn't that far offshore.
Mm-mm.
You know, so you can see it on the horizon, supposedly.
Yeah.
For those of you out there who are immediately drawing comparisons to Atlantis, you're not alone. High Brasil is sometimes referred to as the Atlantis of Ireland, though it actually is more well-documented than Atlantis and has more eyewitnesses.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Supposedly at one point in time, an entire town in Ireland saw this.
Wow. Island.
Yeah. The island of Brasil can be found in Celtic folklore, where its name is derived from Brisal, which means the high king of the world, and can be found on maps, actual nautical maps, dating as far back as 1325.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
It appeared on maps regularly throughout the centuries, despite countless expeditions to find it, until its final appearance in 1865.
Ooh, so it hasn't been seen recently.
A fictional island that was never found was on official maps for over 500 years and as recently as 200 years ago when travel across the Atlantic was common.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, 1865 isn't that long ago. I mean, it's literally not even 200 years ago.
You would think that if you could see it, you could like sail out to it, land on it, wait for like a day to pass and then see what happens.
Oh, well, there's stories about that.
Ooh.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So there are some stories that, and actually I'm going to get to it right now. I forgot that it was this part of the notes. So there are some stories that Brasil and St. Brendan's Island are one and the same, though that has been debated by some historians. So as a quick recap, St. Brendan was an early Irish saint who went on an expedition back in AD 512. Yes, that is a real year for those of us in America who have problems thinking about time before 1776.
Right.
That's me. It's me. I'm talking about me. So he went on this expedition with 14 monks back in 512 in search of the Garden of Eden. from the Bible. His expedition lasted from AD 512 to AD 530, during which time he found an island in the Atlantic off the coast of Ireland that he described as paradise. Claims state it was thickly wooded, mountainous island where the sun never set, and it was always day, where the flora were abundant, the trees bore rich fruit, the rivers ran with fresh water, and the birds sang sweetly in the trees.
Oh, appealing.
Yeah. He and his monks reported that they stayed on the island for 15 days while their ship waited offshore for them to return. However, the crew aboard the ship reported that they waited a year for Brendan's return, which during which period the island remained concealed in a thick curtain of mist. So they only claimed to have been on this island for a little, like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But offshore, it was like, no, you guys were there for a whole year.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Creepy. I mean, to be honest, if you did that, I'd probably screw with you when you got back.
that's fair. They could have just been, you know, pulling their leg. So as far as expeditions, there were actual expeditions, you know, launched to go search for this island. The first one being in 1480. John Jay Jr. departed from Bristol, England, on a journey to find the fabled island, only to come back empty-handed after spending 2 months at sea. In 1481, two more ships, the Trinity and the George, also departed from Bristol on an expedition to find High Brazil with no success. In 1497, Spanish diplomat Pedro de Ayala reported to the Catholic monarchs of Spain that John Cabot, the first European to visit North America since the Vikings, had, quote-unquote, discovered in the past by the men from Bristol who found Brazil. So this implied that someone from those previous 1480 expeditions had actually managed to find it. They didn't report it.
Oh.
So, yeah.
It's like, oh, but then maybe there's a reason. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Maybe. There's always a reason if you don't want to, like, you were looking for it and then you don't want to tell anybody about
it. Maybe. Yeah, maybe there's it was paradise and they just didn't want to share it. One of the most famous visits to High Brazil was in 1674 by Captain John Nisbet of Killybegs Company from Donegal Island, Ireland. Captain John Nisbet of Killybegs Corporation from Donegal, Ireland.
Nice.
Mouthful. He and his crew were in familiar waters west of Ireland when a fog came up. As the fog lifted, the ship was dangerously close to rocks. While getting their bearings, the ship anchored in 3 fathoms of water, and 4 crew members rowed ashore to visit this island, which they later claimed was High Brazil. They spent a day on the island and returned with gold and silver that was given to them by an old man who apparently lived there. The captain said the island was inhabited by large black rabbits and a mysterious magician who lived on a large stone castle by himself. A follow-up expedition was led by Captain Alexander Johnson, who claimed to have found High Brazil, confirming Nisbet's findings. So apparently, you know, a mysterious island with a magician full and, like, giant black bunnies. So
interesting. You know, giant black
pulling
bunnies.
Rabbits and islands out of his hat. The last documented sighting of High Brazil was made in 1872, which was 7 years after it stopped appearing on maps. And this was made by Robert O'Flaherty and TJ Westrup. Westrup claimed to have visited the island on 3 previous occasions and was so captivated by it that he brought his family with him to see it in person. There, they all witnessed it appear out of nowhere, only to see it vanish again before their very eyes. So his entire family saw it.
Oh, wow.
Now, some legends say that, like, if you did see it, you could sail towards it and sail towards it and sail towards it and never reach it.
Oh.
So some people think it was like a mirage.
Smudge on your periscope.
Yeah. So it was like a mirage island.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Or maybe just
a smudge on your telescope.
Dust on your pirate contacts.
Oh my god. Okay. I found a fun tie-in with a previous episode while researching this topic.
Oh. So
in episode 30, you talked about the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident.
Yes.
So, UK Sergeant Jim Peniston claimed to have...
Peniston!
Pretty sure it's Peniston, not Penis Town.
Sorry, guys. We're barely older than 12 here.
So he claimed to have touched the UFO and in doing so telepathically received 16 pages of binary code directly downloaded into his mind.
Wow.
He wrote down the code the next day and had it translated decades later. The code was said to list very specific coordinates of High Brasil and listed the location where ancient cartographers actually had it mapped.
Ooh.
The message also listed the coordinates of several other ancient sites around the world, such as the pyramids of Giza and the Nazca lines, which we haven't talked about the Nazca lines, but we absolutely should. That'd be a great topic.
We've touched on it. Touched on it.
Yeah, but we should absolutely we did go into it more in depth.
Briefly about it, yeah. But that's interesting.
Yeah. And then at the very bottom of the message, the coordinates of High Brasil were listed again, along with an origin year of 8100.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. 1800. Wow.
No, 8100.
8100.
Yes.
Whoa.
So either that is 8100 BC or it's in the future. I'm assuming it's probably BC.
Yeah.
So, as far as explanations for what this was, there is a underwater island of sorts discovered in 1862, called Porcupine Bank, which appears to have been an island at one point in time. So that's why I'm saying it's an underwater island. It looks like it used to be an island and it sunk. It's located about 120 miles or 193 kilometers west of Ireland. So that puts it about the right distance away.
Yeah.
It's a shoal exposed at extreme low tide. And it's where an 1830 chart had Brasil Rock located.
Interesting.
So the bank's highest point is around 200 meters or 656 feet below sea level and was sunk either due to a catastrophe or rising sea levels.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that, like, eventually, then, like, you get the... Although I was thinking, like, do you have low tide 200 miles out to sea? Like, that's
sometimes, like, extreme low tides is what it's saying, so...
That's crazy.
But, yeah, so basically either, like, an earthquake happened and it sunk, or just rising sea level sunk it. So, but islands do sink all the time. Yep. That's a thing that happens.
It's the popping back up that's weird.
Yeah, and that does happen, too. You know, other explanations are that it was the result of navigational errors, which happened a lot with, there's plenty of, phantom islands that were listed on maps throughout history that never existed that could have just been people got lost at sea. Mistaken observations is another one. You know, they thought they saw an island, but it wasn't. It might've just been the back of a whale. Unverified misinformation or simply deliberate fabrication. You know, people lied even back then.
Yep.
So
people do that.
But yeah, so that's all I've got. So I take it back. This episode is not long. It's right on schedule.
Though.
I thought
that's
this was
going to
last longer, but yeah. So that is the mythical island of High Brasil, which may or may not have existed, but definitely did exist on official maps until as recently as 1865.
I wonder what made them take it off. They were just like,
Well, nobody could
Enough
verify that it actually
there.
Existed. Yeah.
Yeah.
They couldn't actually verify it through official means, so they took it off maps.
That's enough. So. We don't want to waste ink on this maybe island.
Yep.
We barely have enough ink for the real islands.
Right. But yeah, it's really interesting. Some maps showed it as, you know, having like a river, like almost two separate islands that basically were just so close together that it was like a river that went through it, like a channel.
Ooh.
Some maps showed it as being a perfect circle.
Like an earth button. Yeah. The earth's belly button.
Apparently, like
sometimes earth eats too much. It's got an outie. Sometimes it's an innie.
Saint Brendan claimed that the island that he visited was a perfect circle. So.
That's wild. That is just wild. Now I need to go to Ireland to go, like, confirm this. I need to go fly
to
over there.
So bad anyway. So, you know, let's just go. Let's plan a trip and go. We'll hit
there.
Up Scotland while we're there and we'll go see Loch Ness.
Exactly. We'll just big old conspiracy road trip. We'll find a Bigfoot over there too.
A cryptopod road trip. Yeah,
exactly. Oh man. Well, that was super interesting. I hope you guys really enjoyed that. I certainly did. And do we have anything else? Any other orders of business to attend to?
I don't think so. No, nothing comes to mind. So.
Well, cool. Then we are we're at March 1st already?
Yeah,
what?
We're at March 1st already.
Oh my gosh. So our next episode, I will be 30.
Oh.
My birthday is coming up.
I know.
So, yes, I spent the last year of my 20s inside with the rest of you. I am just as disappointed as you guys are.
To be fair, I didn't use my last birthday, so I'm not counting it. So we could just say that you're turning 29.
I'm still 29. Well, see, that's the thing. I'm excited to be 30 because at least I'm still young, but at least I know shit.
To be fair, last year though, we weren't on lockdown by your birthday. We didn't go on didn't go on lockdown until like beginning of April.
Yeah. To be fair, but I've been paying attention to the pandemic since January and I've been wearing a mask since February. Right. So I did not do an actual birthday party last year. I had friends over and made dinner and that will probably be the same thing minus the friends this year. but yeah, even last year was really low key. It was just me and two of my friends. So and producer Ian and stuff. But other than that, just going to be pretty low key probably again this year. But looking forward to finally being able to like really celebrate, because now it sounds like they're right as I'm getting close to getting vaccinated. They're probably going to yank that away from me here in California. But
we'll see what happens.
I'm just being patient.
But it's slowly starting to roll out. I got my second shot recently, just in the last couple of weeks. I am thankfully fully
Sammy's
vaccinated.
Protected.
So I'm good to go. And they did just approve the use of a single shot vaccine.
Yeah, I saw that. And then even Fauci has said, he's like, if it's an available version, take it.
Yep.
So if Fauci's okay with it, then I suppose I am too. Yeah. But all right. So I hope you guys are staying safe. Keep washing your hands. Keep wearing your masks. And hey, check out our Society 6 page, our merch store.
Oh, yeah. We still have masks up on our merch store.
We have masks available and I designed them. So get on it, guys. So you guys can rep your favorite podcast on your face. Mm-hmm. Check out our Instagram and stuff. You guys can get all kinds of examples. We've got some very lovely fans and family members who have modeled them for us.
Yeah, my mom and dad are on there with our masks on. So
so
we will be back on March 15th.
Yay!
With another episode. So
awesome.
And so stay
safe.
You go ahead. You do it this time. I always do it.
Yeah, I'll do it this time. All right, guys. Stay safe. Keep washing your hands. Keep wearing your mask. Be patient with each other. Give each other virtual hugs. And don't forget,
Big Brother is watching. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can head over to our website, conspiraciesandcryptids.com.
If you'd like to get in touch with us and keep up with what we're up to, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Cryptopod, CryptiPod, or email us at conspiriesandcryptids@gmail.com.
Finally, if you're vibing with what we're doing, we'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't feel like writing a long review, just put Big Brother is Watching in the description. And don't forget,
Big Brother is Watching.